Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 144 with Greg Rand on why single family is better than multifamily for building wealth. Greg is the chief strategy officer of Renters Warehouse, the single family property management company currently in the process of consolidating the property management business across the nation. Greg and I discuss our views on why we believe single family investing is better than multifamily investing and how to select properties that beat the market. As you listen to this episode, you'll notice Greg's view of real estate as an investment class. In other words, he thinks about buys, owns, and sells houses as though they're stocks or some other easily tradable and liquid asset. We are currently in a unique time here, 2019, as real estate investors in history, with the advent of the available data, the internet, etc. We actually have the ability to invest nationally like no other time in the history of the U.S. This allows you to select the best markets to buy houses according to the data, the population, the government, the cost of living, and of course, the appreciation potential and expectation of rental rate increases that beat inflation. I love this topic, and I could go on for the entire episode, but I will refrain and allow Greg to explain. All right, Greg Rand, welcome to the REI Diamond Show. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Dan. Thank you.
So, Greg, I know you know my name, and I know your name. I'm pretty sure we might have both spoke at one of the same conferences around the country a couple years back. And I remember seeing your company then and seeing you kind of what you're up to now. But for the listeners who haven't heard your name and don't know who you are, do you want to kind of give the background story of what you were doing and how that evolved into what you have going on today?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I can start with the finish line here, or the punchline where we are now. Is I've been at for most of my adult life in one form or fashion, trying to build a national brand for real estate investors. So my background, you know, coming way back out, out in school when I was a young guy, in the mortgage business, in the real estate business, in the real estate tech business. I was right in the middle of all that when real estate collided with the internet back in the 1990s, ran a large regional brokerage company, but started that the housing crisis was a pivotal moment for me, as it was sure for a lot of people, in your audience. Because I'd always thought that real estate was a financial service. The industry that represents homes doesn't treat it that way. Real estate agents, brokers, National Association of Realtors, MLS, all the way to Zillow, nobody treats it like an asset class. And I always was making baby steps in the direction of trying to address that challenge, but the housing crisis made it clear, like, this is the time. A, nobody seems to understand the housing market. Nobody touches it. Everybody made a big mistake in that whole run-up, and everything was done wrong. And there's going to be an investment boom on the other end of this housing crisis. And a lot of people don't believe that. I totally did. So I threw it all in, sold my business interests, and started Own America, which was a company that was intended to be a national real estate brand. You know, Remax is a national real estate brand. Zillow is a national real estate brand. Own America was designed to be some fusion of those two types of things, but specifically for investors in the housing market. And it took 10 years to get to a place where we actually are now executing on the dream, not where it's going to be. You know, we're smaller than we're ever going to be, hopefully, if things go right. But we're in most parts of the country now with this real estate investment firm because my company, Own America. Well, I'll stop there, but that's kind of it's been a long journey to try to create something that I think is important for people that I think are awesome real estate investors who have been neglected by a lot of the professions out there in the real estate space.
And I think we forgot to mention, but where is Own America now? You guys have finished the transaction and closed, or you're planning with the new company?
Yep. Renters Warehouse, which is the biggest single family property manager and single family rental in the country. So that company manages 22,000 doors. They acquired Own America. Own America, the attempt was to build a national brand, but as far as I got, was an online platform for owners of multiple single-family rentals, so owners of portfolios of single-family rentals where they could actually find a market. They could use institutional-level analytics and data for free, track their portfolio, and then find a buyer or find a seller. So it was a trading platform for SFR portfolios, but only because that's as far as I was able to get. I wanted to be national, so I was national with a very thin layer value proposition to a very specialized clientele. Renters Warehouse being the foundation of real estate ownership, you know, the hard part, the ugly part, the tenants and the toilets and everything else. They wanted to establish something sexier. And so now what we've got is the foundation of a property management company upon which we now hung a portal with 1 million rental properties for sale online, with all those cool analytics. And in between the two is a real estate brokerage company. We have 200 real estate agents now that are investment advisors in single family real estate in our 40 offices across the country. And we're on our way to 1,000, you know, over the next 2 years, and hopefully 5,000 over the next 5 years, to really be a household name that just stands for professional services to real estate investors.
Nice. I like that. I like the vision. So my background, a lot of the listeners already know, I actually went shopping for portfolios in the Own America platform. And I remember like weeding through, I think it was like spreadsheets, and I was talking with one of the guys in your office. For me, my money for down payment and, you know, financing that stuff, it just kind of was a little over my head and a little bit past where I happened to be at the time. We do a ton of single family stuff. Like to date right now, it's October 2019, and we've closed 147 deals year to date. In Atlanta, Chicago, and Philadelphia, at an average profit of about $21,000 a piece. So we're kind of busy doing that, but we're like flipping a ton of houses. There's like 15, 16 partners, so it's not like just me, you know, doing all these deals myself or anything. So, you know, where I'm going with that is like for me personally, Greg, long term, like I want to own these properties that I've collected, I don't know, 20 something doors, and I buy one here, one there. And I want to own them long term. It's not like I'm trying to free myself from my day job, like a lot of people who are like getting into real estate, you know, at the beginning level or doing whatever, and they want to replace their income. That's not really where I was starting. But for me, it was more of a savings account. And I was buying properties all cash, you know, 60 grand, just all cash, 90,000, just paid all cash. Now, I wouldn't get like many of them throughout a year. And then I got a little more comfortable. See, I went through the housing crisis too and had gotten myself in a little bit of trouble financially. And so I was like very conservative for like a long number. And now I'm like still, it's like 65% is my debt load. And I have a lot of my cash that would be savings kind of tied up in my properties as we speak. But I add one here, one there, just a couple. It's not like I can grab a whole portfolio. So I didn't really like have much to do on the Own America platform, but yet I'm still, you know, at the level of getting in single family. I use a property manager. And this stuff for me now, it's like I've discovered like, hey, if I buy, you know, I bought like an 10 unit building, and I think I paid like $600,000 or $700,000 and put 20-25% down. I don't remember. But meanwhile, now I have all those tenants who are paying down a $500,000 mortgage so that, yeah, at the end of 15, 20, 25 years, however long it is, that mortgage pay down is significant money. That's an autopilot savings plan that I'm not having to do much for other than rely on my management company. And I have my money kind of in savings there. But I guess for me, it was like hard to get excited much earlier on. When we're making $20,000 a deal, sometimes a significantly higher number than that per deal. And I know a lot of house flippers are probably nodding their head like, yeah, who wants, you know, $200, $300, $400 a month with all that headache of tenants when I'm out here making $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 flipping houses. Even $18,000, $20,000, $25,000 if you're flipping houses at a lower price point. It's like the big paydays are almost addictive for house flippers, right?
Yeah, I totally get it. You know, it's the and I would never try to talk anybody out of doing what you're doing. I would, though, say that, you know, try to keep 10% of what you roll through because, you know, this is not advice to you. It's just advice. I'm not on the flipping side at all. OK, I'm on the accumulation side. I'm slower and steadier. Like all the risk that I take is in the businesses that I start, you know, and there's plenty of that. So I have this mentality where I just have this, and this is something that we have in common, is that this unshakable belief in the U.S. housing market. I marvel at people who get head faked by every stat that comes out that somebody on CNBC or elsewhere reads as negative. And they don't understand that if you stand back, you understand the depth of this market, you understand the depth of the demand drivers, that number one, most people think about the long-term buy and hold accumulation thing as a boring, it's like buying life insurance for your long-term financial planning, like boring, not as hot and sexy as doing flips. And I could agree with that, but it's plenty hot and sexy when you start thinking about, I love to try to pick the places where the demand drivers are looking stronger. Like, I love the people watching aspect of this. Where are people moving? The migration patterns, the population trends. Because I have this really, I've always had kind of an intuitive grasp of population is housing demand. Housing demand equals upward pressure on yields and values. And so therefore, if it's all about where people are going and why, and will that continue, it's all about these hard data points and all these long-term forecasts and this glacial change of population from one part of the country to another. But then it always lands on these soft things like quality of life and culture, and the fit for people in different demographics, which, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs, one of the things that I think we have in common is like, there's a common sense aspect to this, that you learn to like, I don't know why I know this is right, but I know it's right. And then later on you figure out why you believe that and either you were right or wrong. This is one of those asset classes, one of these playgrounds where if you've got a feel for people, and I don't mean like hugging them, and I'm talking about like, what are they, why they do what they do, right? Like, why people are going there? Is that going to keep up? That's been the secret touch that I've had. I haven't had a magic touch, but I've had a good track record. That's why a lot of the big players on Wall Street work with us, and they still do, because we have a good touch of, okay, what's popping next? You know, like, what markets should I be going into to get ahead of the progress, where I'm not guessing, I'm just looking at this slow pace of population change and saying, hey, they're putting a train station there. Why are they putting a train station there? I should buy houses near that train station that I can walk to the train station because it's going to open in 3 years. That's what I'm doing right now in a town in North Carolina. Those kinds of demand drivers that say, we've got a winner here, where I take almost no risk. I buy houses that need no repairs. Your audience is going to laugh at this. You're going to laugh at me. The houses I buy need nothing. I pay asking price for them. I buy in places that I think are going to see a 30% increase in value over the next 5 years because of where they are and what progress they're in the path of. And so it's a low risk, but still a strategic and tactical execution. Doesn't require me to swing a hammer or employ anybody that does, because I'm not good at that.
I like it. I'm actually taking notes here as you're talking. Ironically, that's kind of my strategy too. So one of the things that my, you know, 3 years ago, I think it was, when I landed on Own America and first looked at the business model, and tons of Wall Street firms, big funds, people are collecting 100, 400, 1,000 houses, 12,000 or however many invitation is up to now. And it was like mind boggling to me. And I remember you and the guys talking about the Own America platform. And I'm thinking to myself, like, man, I've sold a lot of houses in my day. I've wholesaled a lot of houses in my day. And like, no one in their right mind wants to buy a property that's tenant occupied. Like, the only reason this guy is going to sell his portfolio is because it's loaded down with a bunch of junk tenants in there that are, and that's been mostly, you know, across America. It's like, it's hard to sell a one-off occupied property. I see them in the MLS all the time, Greg. It's like, I noticed them sitting there and I'm like, wow, what's going on? This one's like a really low active available for sale. Like, why is this the case? And it's like a property. Maybe I'm going to flip something there and I'm wondering, like, oh, okay, it's a tenant occupied property. Like, I get it. I see why no one's really jumping on that. And they take a while to sell, or they hang out there a while, probably difficult to show, et cetera. Now, me personally, I don't have time to do the renovation on a house. We're doing all kinds of flips, all kinds of deals. I'm doing marketing nonstop. Podcasts. I don't have the time to manage a renovation on a property that I'm going to keep as a rental. So, like, I really gravitate and resonate with that strategy that you said. The house needs nothing. I pay asking price. I'm buying it for, you know, what I feel is a fair market value now. I assume it cash flows and you probably rent it out quick. But, like, for me, I'll buy it with a tenant in it as long as the tenant's paying. Or if they're not paying, I'll even buy it then and do the eviction. But I got to know about that up front. So what kind of – is there like a cap rate? Are you putting 20% down on these properties near the train station in North Carolina? Like, what's the structure of that? Are you actually funding deals and bringing in outside capital partners to take –
No, I'm just doing it for myself. I'm just accumulating. And so what I do is I've been busy as can be lately. And so I've been paying cash, and my intention is to accumulate 10 by this train station and then – refinance out of it, or buy half of the 10 and then refinance out and buy the other half. Your point about the tenant occupied thing is that what's interesting about that is you're totally right. It's a product that is complicated, but nobody ever tried to do anything to productize it with the exception of turnkey guys who didn't use the MLS for the most part. They built, a turnkey provider on the one hand. A turnkey provider is a two-sided platform. On the one hand, they've got a flow of distressed properties that they can fix and renovate and, or a tenant. And then on the other side, they're building up a base of investors, either local, regional, national, international, to sell the properties to. Because if you own, look, this is where we decided to turn hard into the portfolio side of the business. Because I started meeting people that had $5, $10, $15 million portfolios that were listing them with us from 1,000 miles away. Never met face to face. I asked them, okay, so you're in Boca Raton. Why aren't you going to one of the 96 real estate companies in Boca Raton, commercial and residential? And they were saying things like, well, I did, but they keep telling me vacate the houses. So it was a big challenge and it was painful. I got plenty of scars to prove how tough it is to sell occupied properties, but for the seller, it's a huge advantage, obviously. You get out of the properties and your cash flowing to the closing. For the buyer, they get the opposite side of that. They cash flow from the closing. If they need to undo some bad decisions on tenants or whatever, they can do that. But the overall machine is yielding while they work that out. They can buy in bulk. But it's a big, gigantic pain in the neck, but nobody else is doing it. And I got addicted to that. Like, I have a hard time doing anything anybody else is doing. I want to be unique in some form or fashion so that and that always seems to mean my whole career has been like, bloodied and embattled over the fact that I'm so addicted to trying to be different that there's never really a recipe to follow. And like a recipe would be nice once in a while. Like, this is what I do and this is what the outcome is likely to be. It's always this, how do I sell all these freaking portfolios, right? But the good news is though, it puts us in a situation where like your audience, people that are real estate investors on the more entrepreneurial level, I find them to be awesome people. I love being around them. They're extremely open. They want to share and they want to be shared with. They're sort of grizzled, but they're nice at the same time. You know what I'm talking about, right? Like they're an interesting pack. Like they don't like a lot of BS, but they like slinging a little bit here and there. They're fun to talk to, but I think it's the lack of a presence of any serious profession to serve them that has made them so open to talking to each other. Because if I've got a passion for real estate and I can't walk into a Merrill Lynch office or a Keller Williams office and get anything of value in those two environments. So I'm going to go to a meetup and I'll listen to a podcast like this. And lo and behold, this whole group, the people that are veterans have learned at some point in their career from other veterans a lot. And the whole pay it forward, share it forward thing is definitely present. So it's a fun crowd to be around, and my whole last 10 years has been around trying to solve their problems if I can.
Yeah, and it is a complex one. I mean, everybody used to say, yeah, the Wall Street will never get into real estate, they'll never compile it. And they've done it. People have scaled these very large portfolios. Let me switch gears just a second here, Greg. So I assume some of these portfolios actually sold. You got the deals done. You closed them. That assumption, either correct me or maybe we could talk about the capital structure of portfolio buyers. So like how many houses was it? Was it 10 million? Was it 15 million? Was there 20, 25% down? Are we talking about like a Goldman Sachs sponsored lender or where is the financing coming from? And is that maybe a different financing source depending on where at in the country the portfolio deal is actually located? Maybe just shed some light because I'm completely ignorant
Yeah, we did $490 million in volume on the platform over a four-year period. So a lot of that was large institutions, the top 10 or 15 players that you could read in an article, that were eating with both hands, right? They wanted to buy. They liked portfolios they can execute in bulk. And most of the sellers in that volume were entrepreneurs who owned 8 or 26. Like our average portfolio was like 22 to 25 units, right? So we had a lot of people who had 7 properties. We had a few people that had 60 or 70, but mostly it was in that narrower band. And so it was basically, it was a consolidation play. It was bigger players. The analogy that I always use that people seem to get a kick out of is, you know, that graph you can picture of a little guppy, and behind the guppy is a slightly bigger fish with his mouth wide open. Behind that fish is a bigger one, bigger one, bigger one. At the end of the food chain is this big beast, right? Well, we didn't used to have a beast in this industry. There was no Wall Street beast that had an insatiable appetite and big wide jaws. But then they appeared. And what it meant is that, number one, when you did have 25 rentals, you had an exit if it was the right kind of stuff in the right place, right, which didn't used to exist. It also meant that if you were a player like you are, that you do 100-something closings in a year, you could take 25 that are just right up the alley and package that 25, knowing you're going to be able to flip it. But you flip that, you buy 25 houses that are just right, package them up with a bow on top, and then turn them over to the bigger fish up the stream, right? That in that food chain continuum. That's important. You know, you think about the industries out there that until the funeral home industry had big REITs that were buying funeral homes, funeral home owners didn't have an exit except for the competitor across the street or the guy in the neighboring town. Then all of a sudden it was like, whenever I want to sell my funeral home, I know that there are 2 or 3 conglomerates that I can go to, and they're paying a multiple of X times X, and I know that I can exit. That has existed in so many businesses. What do you call it? Self-storage went through that. Real estate brokerage went through that when Realogy first came along, started buying up real estate companies. So those big players were the draw of they were the currents that most of the properties we sold fed into. But then over time, more of those mid-sized people started interacting with each other on the platform. And their capital structures were all over the map. I mean, some of these large funds, they were all buying for cash. Whatever their capital structure was, they weren't telling me about it. It was behind the curtain. So they were doing everything, as you can read about, from raising capital, deploying the capital, issuing bonds against that capital, raising more, issuing more, going public, all that stuff on the large scale. On the lower scale, a lot of those same players launched mortgage companies for mid-sized landlords and gave them lower cost financing that was at least somewhat off the shelf underwriting from the standpoint of, you know, you can apply for the loan and know if you're going to qualify or not. There's a lot of private money piling into smaller funds where, hey, Bob over here, he's got 35 rentals. He's going to go buy 100 more, and like a lot of his friends and their friends pile in, and now he's working with other people's money, gets a loan against that. A lot of scrappy stuff like that had gone on. Still does.
How about that? What are your favorite markets? And maybe also a second pin on that same question would be like, what are the markets you've seen out of the $490 million in volume that the bigger players or the beasts, if you will, were gobbling up the smaller guppies?
Yeah, well, we'll start with that. So the first tier of SFR markets were what a lot of people in the industry would call the smile states, right? So North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, across Texas, up as far as Tennessee, and then around through Arizona and Nevada. You throw Chicago in there because it's the only major, major metro in the country where you can generate a yield on a house. The Midwest kind of came alive, but it was all based on like one simple calculation. People are moving south, quality of life, cost of living, better run government, job magnets equals population magnets, and everybody piled in. They bought the same kind of houses for the most part, same places. And in those markets now, the specialty is, like I mentioned, in Charlotte where I live now. I used to be a New Yorker. I am a New Yorker. Once you are, always, right? But the pockets within Charlotte, as I said before, train station over here, highway expansion over there, Lowe's and Home Depot opening up across the street from each other way out there. Like, what's going on, right? But I like to start looking at the next cities that behave like the first cities behaved. So, like, what's the next Orlando or Tampa, right, that has the same fundamentals of Orlando and Tampa, but isn't Orlando and Tampa? They're great cities, but they kind of have their day maybe. And if you want something that's got a little more extra punch coming to it, and the funny thing is, it's right in the middle, Lakeland. Lakeland, Florida is one of our picks right now with some of our clients because it's like one-third Tampa, one-third Orlando, and one-third Lakeland. It's right in between. It's 35, 45 minutes from each of those major metros, but it's at the outskirt of both of them. So just like any major metro, the further you travel out from the center, typically the prices go down. That happened in Orlando and Tampa, but there's one place that actually joins the two of them, and that's Lakeland. It's really cool, right? So I think it's going to pop because it's got two metro suburbs meeting in the middle. I like looking at cities and say, okay, where, like Denver was a monster of an SFR market, not an institutional one, but from the standpoint of the lifestyle and the quality of life and the youth. This is before the weed, right? All that the things that made since 2012, Denver was doing fine, and then it took off like a bat out of hell. And it was because of that lifestyle stuff. All the fundamentals were there. The yield wasn't so great, but the appreciation has been off the charts, and it's all tied to that. So it's like, okay, well, that's great, but I missed it, right? Maybe, but you didn't miss Colorado Springs. There are places outside of Denver that are in the Denver solar system that are connected to the same exact fundamentals that made Denver take off. They just haven't happened yet, or they're only starting to happen now. Like one of my favorite things, if you go to my website, renterswarehouse.com, any property you look at, you can look at the market data. And you can actually go to a place called the Research Center where you can put in any county in the country that you want. And it'll show you my favorite chart, which is a 20-year price appreciation chart. The average price in that county every month for the last 20 years. And what you see when you look at that is, first of all, it's a stress test. The last 20 years in the housing market was a stress test. It started off good, then it boomed too high, then it sort of got hammered, a deep correction, then it fought its way back to recovery. But you can see, was it a steep roller coaster ride? Was it a mild roller coaster ride? Did it sort of defy any part of that roller coaster, you know? And like you could look at Colorado Springs' chart, and it's identical to Denver's until 2013, when Denver took off. Colorado Springs didn't take off yet. I'm predicting that it's going to catch up. It's just behind chronologically. Does that make sense?
It does. Does the population statistics support that theory?
Yeah, they do. And they support the same. I think the same theory can be told that the next Dallas, or the kissing cousin of Dallas that shares the fundamentals of Dallas 20 years ago, is Oklahoma City. I think the thing that shares the fundamentals of Nashville is Chattanooga, right? See where I'm going? Like, they're similar. They just didn't quite pop yet. I think Columbia, South Carolina is already the next big southern city that's going to double in population over the next 10, 12 years because it reminds me of Charlotte in a lot of ways that are very core.
Have you spent a lot of time in these cities, or was this pretty much all demographic and research? I mean, that's how I do mine, so I'm just curious.
I haven't spent a lot of time. I start off in the clouds with the data and the analysis and the sort of the philosophy that let the data tell me a story, right? Data visualization is great. And then the story gets kind of revealed. And then you talk to people. Going there is always great. I've been to all these places, but like when I tell you, I picked Denver, I did a segment on the Fox Business Network 10 years ago. I did like 70 appearances. I was their real estate guy for like a year, right? When I lived up that way. And I had a segment called Where to Invest Now. And it was me trying to be Jim Cramer. Jim Cramer picks a stock. I pick a real estate market, right? And it was a lot of fun, but I put my neck on the line because I went on record. And a lot of what I was picking it based on ended up playing out. And so now, like, you know, we're taking those videos back out of the archive and saying, hey, look, Greg predicted this and predicted that. But in any case, it's, you know, having a sense of where things might be going, but not really guessing because you're just looking for patterns that already displayed themselves over here. And now you think they're going to happen over here. It becomes pretty easy to do.
Yeah, we are really at a great, interesting time here in humanity and real estate in general here. I mean, we have obviously computers and the internet coming on online in our lifetime here. You mentioned that real estate is a financial service, and it's almost as if the data wasn't even available 20, 30 years ago. The data 10 years ago is nowhere near what the data is now with, you know, websites like the Renters Warehouse being able to check out the research. I mean, Zillow, there's an enormous amount of data available at our fingertips to actually analyze and select these different markets. And then we're now able to put in, you know, multiple market property managers to help manage a portfolio that's not just centered in my backyard because I grew up here, and the house across the street came on. It seemed like a good deal, which is how I think a lot of real estate investors, including myself, bought the properties. It was because those houses were nearby. We understood them. We could drive by them. We could visit them. And there was definitely not the kind of homework and research that you just described put into, I don't know if I had to guess, 85, 90% of most real estate investors' portfolio decisions. Can you speak to how someone might want to construct the investment philosophy to make those selections, or any little tidbits of information if someone was just getting started or maybe only has like 6 or 10 properties now and is like, hey, wait a minute, is there a smarter way to go about this beyond what we had already
discussed?
That's
my favorite person in the world. You just described my favorite person in the world. So, yeah, the approach of that we subscribe to, and we think it bears out when you start using it. First of all, you're absolutely right that the data, even the standard methodology to measure what ROI is for a single family home, right? That hasn't really been established. We've established what we believe it is. We're trying to set that standard, and that is ROI is net yield, or really cash on cash return if you have a debt on the property. What is your cash on cash return plus what is your appreciation rate for the market, right? Because a lot of people don't want to put a number on appreciation, but I don't think it's because they don't want to. It's because they didn't really have any kind of good way to do any forecasting. So we use that 20-year average. The average home in America appreciated like 3.8% per year for the last 20 years. And when you look at the county and the state that you're thinking about investing in, you can get a feel for, did this county outperform the national average? Did it outperform the state? How was it from a volatility standpoint during that period of time? And now, if I'm going to get a 6% yield buying a straight up $200,000 house, making $1,000 a month, I pay cash for it, I got 12 grand in profit a year, NOI, there's my 6%. I'm going to get 4% appreciation if the national average, or if the average over the last 20 years holds. So I'm going to have a 10% ROI investment. Now I can dial, this is what our site lets you do. You can dial those numbers up and dial them back, but you can forecast based on that. So it begins with, are you happy with a 10% annual return? A lot of people are when they consider it to be a relatively low risk thing. So once you get a feel, because it really begins with, what are you trying to accomplish? Like, how old are you? When do you plan on retiring? What's the point? Who are you doing this for? What are their names? Right? But then what does the market bear? So figure out what the yields are in the markets that you're most familiar with. Figure out what the appreciation rate is. We reveal that for free. Decide if you like it. And like, being near where you live is obviously ideal because you're nearby, right? So your surveillance capabilities are top notch. If you're a New Yorker and you can't get a yield to save your life on a single family home, well, then what other markets do you like that you understand that you spend time in? You know what the answer usually is? Florida. You know, we go on vacation to Florida. My parents live in Florida. So let me take a look at the west coast of Florida, because when there's a hurricane going, I know because grandma's there. So I'm not going to get caught flat footed by a hurricane bearing down on my investments. I'm at least going to have my eye on that market because I've got an anchor in that place. So it all goes to where before what, right? I don't recommend chasing deals because I've seen people chase deals to the wrong place. Right? They didn't care where the market was. They cared how good of a deal they were going to get. If you're doing short-term stuff, that's fine. But if you're thinking long-term, location, location, location is the right starting point. So the place, you're buying the place. Philosophically, if I'm going for Lee County, Florida, I'm buying houses in Lee County, but I'm technically buying Lee County. Like, I'm getting deeds to these places. So start with the where. What are the fundamentals? What's driving the market? What do I have a comfort zone with? And then once I'm there, now how much tolerance do I have for repairs? How much tolerance do I have if I'm 1,000 miles away? Probably not much. But what does the face value in Lee County, Florida generate? Face value house, market price, perfect condition, market rent, 5.5% yield plus another 5% appreciation. Okay, 9.5. I like it. Now I've got a property to fit into my portfolio. That makes sense?
Yeah. Yeah, and we haven't even touched on or counted like the depreciation, so tax benefits, or you know, the power of the leverage and having tenant pay down and all those kind of things that we've already figured that out if we have 6 or 7 or 8 rentals. A couple years ago, well, I guess it was a year or so back, I did a podcast episode on my own Actually, it was a presentation I recorded on my own personal investment philosophy, and I'm a big fan, just like you talked about buying around that train station, of buying my rentals in neighborhoods. I'm in Philly and I'm in Chicago with my rentals because I'm comfortable there. I know the areas enough and I've comped a lot of deals there to where when I'm asking the question, where before what, I'm asking, where is it that, you know, these neighborhoods are starting to change over? And Philadelphia has a couple of those spots. South Philly, you know, the rents are increasing faster than everywhere else. Same thing kind of with Chicago. My question, I guess, for you, Greg, these portfolios, 10, 20, 100, however many of these are, if you look at single family investing the way that you've described, and we focused our whole conversation here, versus I'm sure you've probably seen the shiny object of, oh, maybe I should get into multifamily investing. And a lot of people in the market are 100, 200 units. One or the other in your own preference and why?
Yeah, great question. So I like single family. I chose to be in this space because of the following. Number one, the reason why this market is so resilient, the reason why no matter what has come at it, even a crazy time 10 years ago, I knew it would come back, and not everybody believed that. I wrote a book called Crash Boom in 2009 because I think there's a crash, but I know there's a boom, and I wanted to try to get on record with that. I think I sold 9 copies on Amazon, so it's a huge, huge bestseller.
Nice.
But the cover stands, right? I said it. It's directly – I think that the United States of America – is the best product ever conceived. Okay? Living here is the most in-demand thing ever conceived. People can moan and groan about the state of anything whenever they want to, but one thing remains, people want to be here. When they're here, they want to stay. You know, even when the celebrities get on TV and say, if so-and-so becomes president, I'm leaving, they never go anywhere, right? Nobody here wants to leave, and everybody who's out there, many of them want to come. They're all going to live indoors. They're going to eventually want to have dogs and kids and want a house. And so it is the most core in-demand thing that I can think of. Now, multifamily is residential real estate, so it qualifies under that same kind of a thing. But the value of a single-family home is supported by home ownership interest. Home ownership demand is still, you know, 80% of all the home sales a year. So if I own an apartment building and for some reason it becomes obvious to me because of economic conditions that I should sell, I've got to find somebody dumb enough to want to buy when I think it's time to sell. If I've got, and I'm not trying to be facetious, but the point is that I have to find somebody who thinks the opposite about this product. A multifamily building is one thing. It's a rental building. A single family homes can be one of two different things. It could be a rental home or it could be an owner-occupied home. And owner-occupied, they got married, they're buying a house. They don't care the economy's not great. All right, if they had a kid, they're getting out of the apartment and buying a house. Like that decision, home ownership decisions are driven by life, not economics. And so I can have an economic point of view, and I haven't had one yet that caused me to want to sell properties, but if I ever do, it's almost like a risk mitigation feature of single family homes that the buyer may very well wind up being a home buyer, in which case it could be the wrong time to buy a rental property, but it's the right time to buy a house, and I still have an exit, or more importantly, along the way during my hold period, no matter which way the economy goes, economy cranks, home ownership is up, I win because the house appreciated. Economy stinks and home ownership drops out and home prices don't go anywhere, I win because my yields go up because rental demand goes up, right? So two sides of a coin, I think, is a really meaningful feature. And the last thing is, if I owned 100 doors and I wanted to sell 3 of them to buy a Ferrari or a boat or send a kid to college or pay a tax bill or make some other deal someplace else, I can't sell 3 doors. I can sell 3 doors in single family.
Yeah, I think that's well said. I really like that. I agree with it. Kind of sums up a lot of the things I haven't put to my own. I haven't articulated myself the liquidity of the single family as an asset to be able to cut off 3, like you said, to buy the Ferrari. I also like to control my own investments. So rather than me pooling, you know, 15, 20, 30 people's money to buy the multifamily, or being one of the 15 or 20 people who invest $50, $100, or $250,000 into someone else's multifamily project, and then doing that with multiple operators, I'm always building my portfolio and trying to be organized. So, like, God forbid I die tomorrow, Greg, my heirs have a spreadsheet with the single families, and it's got my lenders, and it's got the property managers on there, and it's got the life insurance policy, so that it's organized enough that they can pick pull the estate apart after I'm gone, and I didn't leave them with like a nightmare. Like, who are these operators? And like, what are, like, they don't know what they've gotten themselves into. So I kind of like the control of it on the single families too, when I look at them.
Yep. That's very similar to what I'm talking about. Exactly.
Yeah. So cool. I am curious if you could go back, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 years, when you're just starting out your career, and share with yourself the crown jewel of wisdom, Greg, what would that be?
I love that question. So I have a 15-year-old and a 17-year-old. So I have shared this crown jewel with them. When I was way back in the day, I'm guilty of it today. I used to get heckled by teachers and other adults in my life for daydreaming, right? They'd be talking to me and I'd be looking out the window. They thought that I was distracted, but I wasn't. I was thinking about something else. I was thinking about what I wanted to do, right? I found over time that that was the most practical thing I'd ever done. That daydreaming, like I ended up exactly where, I shouldn't say exactly, because I modified the target. Every time I missed a target, I just changed the target a little bit. Like, oh, I ended up where I wanted, even though it wasn't exactly where I wanted. But daydreaming is pragmatic, is the advice. Like, don't think, like, you do, if you can vividly picture what things will be like in 10 years and 15 years or 5 years, if everything you're doing works, you are increasing your odds, because you begin to intuitively know a decision that I'm about to make is going to get me sort of in that direction. I don't know if I'm trying to go true north and I have to go north, northeast, or as long as I don't go south, I'm okay. But so knowing what the north is the first step in being able to not take any steps in the wrong direction, and usually at least be going if you're not going directly at it, you're making your way towards it because you know what it is. And daydreaming was a technique. It started out as a distraction and ended up being a life technique, and it serves me to this day.
How about that? Yeah, I can relate. I know that I intentionally, you know, while I'm meditating, it's not just like focus on my breath, but I'm like, I'm blocking everything out and I'm like intentionally daydreaming, and I'm running through my mind. Sometimes I'm like constructing what I want the future to look like. And sometimes that's as stupid as like, I got a house I got to sell and it's not. And I'm like visualizing a buyer walking up the front steps. And other times it's, you know, planning out and mapping out what my real estate portfolio is going to look like, or a number of other, obviously, things that we could apply that to. I love it. Greg, book recommendations, one or two, maybe one for the beginner and one for the experienced investor like myself doing, you know, multiple deals per year.
Well, neither one of them are real estate books, but they're both like one of my favorite books of all time is Shoe Dog by Phil Knight. Have you read or listened to that one?
I have.
Listened to it. Yeah, it was like having grown up with that company around, but not realizing what a struggle they were in for most of the time. Just an iconic brand. But the way that thing played out as an audiobook was like a novel. I can't believe Phil Knight wrote that, but he did. And it was just a brilliant story of breakneck risk for like three decades. It made me feel like whimpering over being 10 years old as a company and not having shot through the ceiling yet. I was being a wimp when I saw that he spent 30 years and he was still like, if one boat full of shoes were on their way here from the Far East and it sunk, they were out of business every time. I just love that book. I thought it was like such a beautiful story that was not sealed until like literally, you know, 15 years ago. The second one is Play Bigger. Have you heard of Play Bigger?
Actually, I haven't.
Play Bigger is great. Definitely read it. Again, I don't read. I listen. I think of myself as like the emperors of old who have people read books to me. That's, you know, I don't have to read. I can just sit back and listen. That's another one. That's a modern day book that I think will be a classic on business strategy that uses all the modern day grand slams like Uber and Airbnb and the companies that we've seen come out of nowhere, and then bring it all the way back to things that are 100-year-old companies and what were the, you know, those things, those good to great types books, positioning type books that give you the success stories and the common threads. Play Bigger is a strategic book. I'm the chief strategy officer at Renters Warehouse. I believe strategy is a discipline. It's not just a fluffy word. And this book is the anchor to a thing called category strategy, which we're trying to execute over here at Renters Warehouse. So that was one that changed my life.
Can't wait to check it out. Greg, if anyone wants to take a look into your company, get in touch, what is the best way they can find you?
Renterswarehouse.com is, you can see what I'm working on, and LinkedIn is my favorite platform. So Greg Rand, G-R-E-G-R-A-N-D at LinkedIn.
Cool. Hey, I got like 3 pages of notes. This was a fun episode for me. I learned a lot myself. I'm sure the listeners are nodding in approval here. So I appreciate you like closing the door, you know, to all the distractions and giving us this time. I know you're super busy, and I really appreciate you coming on the show.
It was a lot of fun. I really appreciate you having me.
And thank you for tuning in to this episode of the REI Diamond Show. Keep an eye out for the next episode. Returning guest is our economist, Paul Sloat, a regular guest of the REI Diamond Show, to shed some light on what we might expect in the economy and around the world going into 2020. Are you a deal maker? I buy a ton of houses in Atlanta, Chicago, and Philadelphia. Here at Diamond Equity, we've closed on 190 deals year to date for a gross profit of $4.3 million. And we have another 82 houses in the inventory waiting to be sold and settled or under construction. That said, we have plenty of investment capital ready to buy, and I'm ready to buy more. So if you have a deal, please contact me directly using the form at reidiamonds.com. Are you an accredited investor interested in short-term passive mortgage investment opportunities with double-digit returns? Head over to fundrehabdeals.com to check out available high-yield investment opportunities. That concludes this episode. Thanks again for tuning in to the REI Diamond Show.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.